BCFM, community radio for Bristol on 93.2 FM. For more information or to listen live on the internet, go to our website at www.bcfm.org.uk. BCFM, your radio.
Welcome to the Friday the 16th of January edition of Dialect Radio. Coming to you from our Queen Square studio, up tonight we hear from Bristol's only Palestinian journalist. We also hear from someone who's been predicting the credit crunch, or the credit catastrophe, for the last 40 years, from the Green Party's economic group. We also have the start of our new serial, The History of the Mafia, read by Malcolm Grieve. And we also have Jeff here with the What's On Guide, as ever. But first of all, we're going to hear some music. This is Rush with Spirit of the Radio. Well, Rushners will have noted at the start of the track, oh, I introduced that as Spirit of the Radio. It is, in fact, Spirit of Radio. Apologies to the Canadian Rock Act, if they're listening. I'd like to now hand over to my co-presenter and sometime engineer, Mr. Tony Gosling.
Thanks, John. I'm joined in the studio this week by what we think is Bristol's only Palestinian journalist. And if there are any more Palestinian journalists out there, let us know. But anyway, Iqbal Tamimi, welcome to Dialect.
Thank you very much.
How did you come to be in Bristol?
I was in Birmingham first, and then I joined the university to do my MA degree. And I am an exiled journalist, so I joined Bristol just in May, last May.
And why did you have to leave your home country?
Well, I think not many people know about it, but we were forced to leave our country. I myself came from a city called Hebron, which was occupied by the Israelis in 1967. And what happens is that me and my family, we have been on the other side of the river when they invaded my city, so we could not come back. And we ended up in Jordan, and, you know, all the Palestinians like myself, there is almost 4 million, more than 4.5 million Palestinians are exiled all over the world now. They can't go back home, and I am one of them.
So anyway, tell us what it was like growing up in that part of the world.
It's, if you are outside your country, you have no dignity whatsoever. And if you are stripped of your memories, your home, your belongings, you can't join your family, you can't enjoy weddings or graduation. It's just memories. You can't even enjoy memories. And it's heartbreaking. Many of my relatives died. I could not attend their funerals. Many graduated, got married. It's just like being amputated from your past. It's just drifting in this world.
Well, yeah, I understand that's after you had to leave. But what about when you were growing up in Palestine? Can you go back to those days?
Oh, yeah. It was beautiful. I mean, I remember every detail because I came from an area which is extremely nice area. And it is the city of Abraham, who is the grandfather of all the prophets. And we have sort of beautiful nature, and we have close relationships between people. And I think that sometimes when I think of my country, I feel like as if God has, you know, cut a piece of heaven and just sent it down, you know, to earth. And it's my hometown. And I don't know where to start. I mean, my memories are rushing with lots of images about my childhood and how we used to go and enjoy, you know, having a look at the people who are making the drums or, you know, harvesting the grapes or weddings. And, you know, it's very safe. Children can go, you know, different areas without, you know, having to be asked about them, where they have been. And we have lots of wells for water where I used to enjoy playing with the, you know, the young girls. I remember being the only one with a doll, because the girls in our local area used to make their dolls on their own, and they taught me how to make these things. And of course, my grandparents' home have a big place in my heart, because I remember every tree, even the animals, the birds, everything. I mean, it's very difficult to talk about it. Sometimes I sort of like focus a lot, try to bring back those pictures into, close my eyes, bring back those pictures. It's like being in a nightmare that you found yourself one day without anything. You're just stripped of everything, you know?
So as a journalist now, how are you finding it easy to get work in Britain?
I couldn't get any, to tell you the truth. It's another story, because all my experience was in the Middle East. I worked for 15 years. But here, I mean, even the local journalists, my colleagues, are finding now it is very difficult to find a job.
So what were you doing? What sort of journalism were you doing over in Palestine?
I've done everything. I started... I was maybe the first lady blogger in my country. It was very, very, you know, early. And I was, my blogs were sort of sarcastic, political blogging in Arabic. And it was a little bit odd because they are not used to Muslim ladies or Arab ladies who look like a mother, you know, who talk in that, use the internet. And because I am a poet, I used a certain kind of language which has lots of symbolism, because we don't have full freedom to talk about politics. You end up talking in simple using symbolism, you know, in criticizing. It's more like, you know, the Animal Farm thing kind. And I was a radio presenter. I worked as a TV producer as well in Dubai, in the news. And I worked as a journalist. I've been writing for different magazines and periodicals. I have published lots of research and books. But I ended in England, nobody. I even try to apply for different jobs, which does not even have to be on the same level of my education. I applied for something really less that I can do, like research, like, you know, translation, anything. But I was not lucky yet. So I joined the university. I became a student after I used to be a lecturer. I used to be lecturing, you know, for media students, because when I started working in the media, they did not have, you know, the strict rules that they have now, that you're supposed to have a PhD or something. It, you have to be talented, and you have to grab people's attention and convey a message and make them just stick around to hear your program. And that was good enough.
Well, anyway, you're in the UK now, and you do have a bit of freedom of speech, at least here.
I don't think so.
Yes, but you do at the moment. So can you give us your take on the recent events, particularly in Gaza? Obviously, Christmas and New Year 2008-2009 seen the bombing of what is essentially a zone which people, civilians, can't get out of.
It's heartbreaking, because I forget
How well do you know Gaza?
I know the people of Gaza because it has been sieged for a long time. And Gaza itself is sort of cut off the rest of the West Bank. It's like, you know, another territory. It was sieged for a long time. I know Gaza very well because all my colleagues in Gaza who are journalists, I'm thankful that we have an invention called the internet, because we talk to each other, we exchange photos and pictures and reports and videotapes, and it's almost like living in a virtual home. You don't have to be there with your body. And I am at the moment, we are all grieving because we have four of our colleagues have been killed lately in Gaza by the Israeli army, and we have two are kidnapped by and imprisoned. Nobody knows about them, where they are. I forget about myself being a journalist when I think of Gaza. I feel like I'm a mother only and a grandmother, because I have also grandchildren. And journalism is a kind of, it's a profession which makes people bond to each other in a very strange way. I mean, we support each other even if we are not in the same country or we don't belong to each other's, you know, profession. I knew names. I never seen faces of many people who I supported in different countries. And at the moment, I have a network online where I have 400 members from all over the world who are supporting me. They are my colleagues. Some of them are freelancers, some are photographers, some are trapped inside Gaza and they can't go out, and they just wait. They send me reports and I say, how do you do it? They say, we wait until there is some kind of like a truce, and we go out because we don't have electricity or internet access. We go to, there is a small number of foreign media establishments which they allow us to send our emails from. I have received one of the emails from a colleague of mine. She is a photographer. She's a Palestinian journalist as well. She told me, I feel like we are living something like before the Middle Ages. We don't have water, we don't have electricity, we don't have anything. Our children are really screaming because they are hungry. And there is no transport, of course, no heating. And she said, the last door on my wardrobe I burned to make food. You know, they took off, they cut their wardrobes and they made fire out of their books to make a little, you know, to warm some water and things like this. It is heartbreaking, you know. And while I am here sometimes, even, you know, if I eat something, I feel like, you know, guilty, because I know that the children are not eating anything. Those children I'm talking about who stay alive, because some mothers, I've seen you know, the reports have been collecting bits and pieces of their children and looking for parts which they could not find under the rubble.
But it does seem like a bit of a hopeless battle that Hamas is fighting. And there are some people who would say Hamas is really causing this problem by trying to shell Israel with these little rockets also by calling for or by making statements saying that Israel has no right to exist. These aren't really helping matters, surely.
This is why I stopped writing and believing in mainstream media, because it's all rubbish, you know. I worked in the mainstream media and I know how we've been bossed around and that there is agenda for each establishment, and this is not the reality. This is why my colleagues, even from England, went over there, because they wanted to see really what life like. Everybody knows that Israel has broke the truth. They had a ceasefire for 6 months, and they went inside and they killed 6 people before the end, just a few days before the end of the ceasefire. And we heard a lot about, you know, shelling from the Palestinian side, which is from Hamas side, but nobody showed you what kind of rockets they have used to defend themselves. I've seen the pictures. They are more like the fireworks that the children use. They made it by hand. You can't compare it at all with the tons of, you know, explosives that was raining on the children. 1,000 people died, innocent people died. And, you know, I every single life is important. Every single life. I don't care if it's from the Palestinian side or from the Israeli side, but they are trying to make that kind of impression that it is a sort of a religious background, which isn't. It has nothing to do with religion. Hamas as well was elected democratically, and people want Hamas, but the West, they don't want Hamas. So they play kind of a double standard, kind of democracy. They want democracy their own way. This country is Hamas's country, and the people chose Hamas. You can't force people to change it. They chose them because they have contributed to the local people. They helped people regarding their social life. It has nothing to do with, you know, what the militarizing thing which the media is focusing on at the moment. And to tell you the truth, the Gaza people have nothing to lose more. They've lost everything. They don't care if they die. They don't. They have been under siege for such a long time. They can't have food. They can't have access. Even the water. They can't go fishing in their own water. They can't have fuel. I mean, when you sort of ask somebody if you want to die immediately or slowly, he would choose to die mercifully, with mercy, immediately. They have nothing else to fight for. And the media in the West, they have very short memory. They just talk about the last few days. Nobody remembers that these people have been oppressed for 60 years. They have been terrorized for 60 years, many massacres. The whole issue came surfaced now because there is, thank God, there is something called new media, which allowed people to compare and to receive pictures and reports from another source, which is not what we are used to.
So can you recommend some English language, English language internet sites where people could go to get good information from Palestine, given that there's only a little bit trickling out?
There is many. You can't believe the kind of solidarity that human beings have for each other. I myself used to write and still read the Palestinian think tank, because there is a sort of a cooperative kind of journalism, the Jewish and the Muslims, in Palestine, in Israel, all over the world. They are talking about human issues. They are talking about reality.
So can you just Google that?
Of course. And there is many. If you write Palestine, you will end up with thousands of websites, and there is lots of good people all over the world who are trying to, you know, join hands and help each other from different faiths, because now they are educated, they have access, they are not, they try to escape censorship, which is we all suffer from streamlined media everywhere. And they compare. People started to compare things and get information.
So obviously you've got your own blog, which has got some signposts for people. Whereabouts can we where can people find your blog?
My blog, I started for mothers because I knew the only thing that makes us, you know, the only thing we have in common with each other is motherhood and love. Unconditional love. So my blog is Palestinian Mothers. If you just write Palestinian Mothers, you will find a website where people write about these things. And most of my, of course, it's not just for mothers because there is males as well, and they are born from mothers as well. So the love of mothers is there to remind us what we have in common, that children are precious everywhere, regardless of the faith of the parents. So I will defend any child. When I started to talk about the issue from mother's point of view, I found that women or mothers all over the world, they share the same things with me under their skin. They have families they want to protect. We don't care about oil. We don't care about gas. We don't care about, you know, currencies. We want our children home. And that's it.
Okay, so... As a final sort of addendum at the end here, could you just say what you think the solution is over in Palestine-Israel conflict? Because, you know, we've had endless images of the horrors of what's going on, but I'm really interested to hear, you know, how you see things, if it's possible to have peace.
It is possible. We've been living before the creation of this Israel, Jewish and Christian and Muslim, Palestinians, next to each other in the same neighborhood.
So are you saying then that the Jewish state shouldn't exist, that the Israeli state shouldn't exist?
No, it's not that. We can have a democracy like England, and religion is something personal. It's a choice. Even there is Palestinians who are defending Palestine, and they are atheists, and they are some communists. You can't tell them that this is not your country. You can't defend your country because you have a different faith. Faith is something. They just created these issues for other agenda. People can live next to each other and with each other, regardless of their faith. And there can be always elections, and there can be a parliament who can provide the best to his community, can become a speaker on behalf of the the city or the area. The struggle has nothing to do with religion, and people can live really peacefully. I am in contact with many Jewish women, and they are really good ladies, and we have everything in common with each other, and they don't like children being killed. And even now, students at the secondary school, Jewish students now, they are going to prison because they don't want to serve in the army. They don't want to kill their peers. So I think there is lots of hope. There is lots of hope. This is what keeps us going, you know.
Okay, that's lovely. Thanks.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much to Iqbal for coming in today and talking to us, and thank you to Tony Gosling also. And just a note that if you do want to read her blog, apparently you can Google Palestinian Mothers, and that will wind your way to that website. And of course, the internet through which this show has come to you, the medium, if you're not listening to PCFM, that is, does mean that it does enable people to get in contact with each other, as obviously she elucidated in the interview. So viva the internet, and boo for people like Google, who of course, and Yahoo, who work in cooperation with various people like the Chinese state, etc., in order to stop people using the internet.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
We're now going to cut on to Brian Leslie, who's part of the Green Party Economic Group. And he was talked to by Tony Gosling earlier on, and he's going to chat about the printing of money, the credit crunch, and something interesting about the Bank of England and Basel in Switzerland.
Well, I'm Brian Leslie. I was born in 1930 at a time when my father was campaigning hard on monetary reform, and I've spent my lifetime aware of the problems of money, mainly the problem of who creates it and how it's created. And I've been producing the magazine Sustainable Economics on behalf of the Green Party's Economics Policy Working Group for 16 years.
Now, I've been subscribing to your magazine, Green Economics, and it's one of those magazines that's been talking about this for a very long time. So it's quite ironic, I think, that we're hearing a lot of stuff, particularly on the broadcast media, of people saying, well, nobody predicted this.
Yes, well, as I said, I've been predicting it. My father was predicting it in the 20s, and, of course, the Second World War saved the economic system for the time being. Without that, it would have crashed then. There's a smokescreen of complicated language which defends the system. Also, the banks control the media rigidly. Between the wars, there were broadcasts and articles and widespread debate about the nature of the money supply. Since the war, this has been strictly forbidden in the media. You cannot get it mentioned, cannot get it debated. In the first post-war elections in Canada, I happened to be listening to the radio at lunchtime when they announced the result of the elections in British Columbia. The Social Credit Party, which was campaigning for monetary reform, gained a landslide victory. I think it was something like 58 out of 63 seats in British Columbia, where they'd not even stood for it before. Now, the 1 o'clock news, lunchtime, gave the result and a few paragraphs about the aim of social credit. I then listened to the 6 o'clock and 9 o'clock news in the evening. They didn't even mention the result, let alone what social credit was all about. And since then, there has been no mention on the media of how money is created and the problems that it causes.
Well, you talk about a smokescreen. Can you just, in a nutshell, help us see through that smokescreen and explain how it really does work?
Yes. Well, the banks create money by lending. They don't lend out any money they actually already have. They enter into their books a loan as a liability to them, because they have to pay out when that loan is made, and also an asset because the borrower owes them the money, so the books balance. That means that they can create virtually endless money simply by entering figures in books when they make a loan. These are, of course, all interest-bearing. Meanwhile, the government creates notes and coins, and they are spent into existence. Now, that used to be the main source of money in the country over the last centuries. In fact, most of the money was coins created by the government and spent into circulation. Because of the gradual taking over of the money supply as credit, which the banks have created, the use of notes and coins has diminished. At the end of the last war, about 46% of our money was still notes and coins spent into circulation by government. The rest was credit, which the banks had created. Now, because notes and coins are only used for very small change of money changes, only about 3% of our money supply is created without creating a debt, because it's spent into circulation. That means that virtually all our money has interest-bearing debt alongside it, so that inevitably debts have grown and grown and grown. If that money had been spent into circulation by government, it wouldn't mean that no one ever borrowed, but it would mean that there would be far less need to borrow, because the money would already be there, and when people borrowed, they would be borrowing money which already existed. They wouldn't be creating new money. This is the essence of the problem. It's quite simple and straightforward, but it's hidden behind a smokescreen of complicated different ways of describing it, and of course the different uses of it.
Now, we've just heard this week that Alistair Darling is talking about the government printing money, albeit in secret. Is this going to do something, do you think, to offset that balance?
This, again, is something which it does look as though in Britain and America they are, in fact, proposing for the government to create and spend more of the money, but they're not straightforwardly saying that. They're hiding it in a smokescreen of special terms. We've been trying, various people have been trying to get a straight answer from the government. They've been writing and getting answers which never give a straight answer. I've tried it myself, and various other reformers that I know have been trying to get a straight answer, and you cannot get one.
Well, you mentioned there briefly the fact that there is this kind of money reform movement.
Yes.
Could you talk about some of the groups there are as part of that movement?
Well, in Britain, there's the Bromsgrove Group, which I have been part of for some years. This is a group which meets annually in Bromsgrove near Birmingham. The one thing they have in common is that they want to create, they're promoting monetary reform. They have various other backgrounds and ideas and interests. In America, there's the American Monetary Institute, which has been in existence for a few years and is having an annual conference. And Dennis Kucinich, who was a Democratic vice presidential candidate, is behind that. He's still a congressman who's speaking out loud and clear in Congress about the need for monetary reform and supporter of the American Monetary Institute. In Canada, there's a monthly magazine which has been in production for 20 years called Economic Reform, which, again, the people behind that have been campaigning all that time, contacting government officers and holding conferences and so on. And, of course, there's also the social credit movement, which was growing massively between the wars and nearly died out since then, but has kept going and is still growing again in this country and in Australia and New Zealand and Canada has not... it's kept fairly strong. In New Zealand, between the wars, they persuaded the New Zealand government to start a bank and use it to lend to the government at low interest to put in a massive building program, house building program, and kept New Zealand out of the depression to a large extent by that means. Australia also has its own bank, which did the same. Canada nationalised its bank in 1938 and funded a large part of the war spending with its own money from its own national bank. It's not quite the same as creating and spending, but it's at least if the government borrows from its own bank, then the interest it pays comes back to it as dividends. Well, in fact, in Britain, the Bank of England was nationalised in 1946, but its policy didn't change. And the government could borrow from its own bank, but it doesn't. It borrows from commercial banks and pays interest, and the interest on the national debt is billions a year. It's as much as we spend on health and education.
So most of us think of the Bank of England as sort of in charge of all this stuff. To what extent is the Bank of England really at the centre of the British money system?
Well, in fact, all the central banks are linked together with the through the Bank of International Settlements, which meets in Basel. It has regular meetings of the central bank governors to decide policy internationally. And although the various of the national banks are government-owned, the government doesn't dictate their policies to any realistic extent. It's dictated behind closed doors in Basel in Switzerland by the Bank of International Settlements.
Okay, Brian. So the way things are going, it's looking, all the time we're getting more bad news economically, even though it's not supposed to be officially a recession. It certainly looks as if it's going that way. And we've had some other commentators on our program saying pretty much that. What's your prediction for the next 12 months or so?
Well, I think it's very fluid. I think that the bankers have realised they've overstepped the mark, they've created too much debt, but they're still trying to hang on to their power and influence and wealth. The governments, there is a lot of pressure for radical change. At the same time, they've still got the powerful vested interests fighting that.
So if you were the Chancellor of the Exchequer right now, or an advisor, if you had the ear of the Chancellor, what would you be advising?
I would be advising that they should do what the American Monetary Institute is proposing in its draft American Monetary Act. That is, stop the banks from creating money and take over that power by the government, and the government should be spending it into circulation. And I would recommend that a large part of that initial spending to maintain the money supply should be by issuing national dividends, citizens' incomes, basic incomes, whatever you like to call it, an unconditional payment to all citizens of a basic living allowance, so that they then have the economic freedom to choose what sort of employment they undertake, under what terms, and they would have economic democracy, as Douglas, the originator of the social credit idea, termed it. That would give them the freedom to have a guaranteed share of the potential productive capacity of the economy unconditionally, and they would have a choice of how much to engage in that production to gain extra.
So you really think that the government should just be giving everybody something for nothing?
Not something for nothing, something in recognition of the productive capacity of the world, in fact, and allowing the system to wind down. We desperately need to stop this ever-increasing production, most of which is utterly wasteful. The amount of waste there is involved in free advertising newsletters, packaging, surveillance of benefit fraudsters, which is far more vigorously promoted than surveillance of the gamblers on the money system and the high-level cheats, which virtually go uninvestigated. The system is totally corrupt, and it's aiming for totally wrong aims. We do not need full employment. We need full payment, pay out to people enough to use what is already being produced without having to produce more and more and more in order to pay out the wages to allow them to buy some of what is actually produced, at the same time as accumulating ever more and more debt. None of this is necessary.
Okay, Brian, just finally then, can you steer us towards your website? And I know you've got a video cast as well.
Right.
Maybe if you could just explain how you can Google that up, how you can find that on the web.
Yes, well, the video cast is moneymyths.org.uk. And my magazine is thustechweb.co.uk. That's Sustainable Economics website. That's sustecweb.co.uk. My viewpoint from the start has been that what is physically possible must be financially possible. And it's been clear to me through my life that what is physically possible is production of all that people reasonably need without having to produce more and more and more beyond that.
How much is it to subscribe to your magazine?
Well, to view it on the web, of course, it's free, but an annual subscription is £10 or a minimum of £5 if £10 is too much.
That was Brian Leslie, an editor of the Sustainable Economics magazine, talking to Tony Gosling earlier on today. He's part of the Green Party Economics Group, and I'm sure if you Google all of that, you'll find lots of interesting stuff.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
It's now time to hear from the actor Malcolm Grieve, who in the previous year was reading Laurie Lee's Sided with Rosie. And we've got a brand new serial starting this week. This is The History of the Mafia.
The History of Organised Crime by David Southwell. St. Augustine of Hippo once said, "For what are states but large bandit bands? And what are bandit bands but small states?" Organised crime holds a constant fascination for many people. Outlaw mystique exists in folklore the world over. Whispered tales of the deeds carried out by the Garduña, a secret Spanish criminal society, were a staple of storytellers in the Middle Ages. The combination of secrecy, power and violence hiding in the shadows of our daily lives, represented by organised crime, is the stuff of countless newspaper headlines today. Maybe it's because of our desire to know more about what is hidden from us, even if it is the underworld. Organised crime is, by conservative estimates, a $1 trillion business that operates in every country in the planet. The key word of the 21st century is globalisation, and no other human activity better illustrates international interconnectedness than the modern structured criminality. Every nation has an underworld, but in today's global economy, a parallel global gangland has emerged, where transnational criminal organisations, or TCOs, control more economic power than some nation-states. Like legitimate global corporations, TCOs have utilised the system of international trade and advances in communication technology and travel. They have evolved complex alliances, connections and arrangements that mean, for example, that the activities of a Colombian cocaine cartel could have an impact on both the behaviour of a Brazilian street gang and a corrupt Chinese politician under the influence of a triad society. The TCOs span the globe, and their actions reverberate through the organised crime groups that are active in every territory and illicit activity found on the planet. It is not surprising that authorities have found tackling TCOs difficult when you learn that even in the 21st century, law enforcement and other agencies have not even been able to agree on a single definition of what organised crime is. For the purposes of this book, however, organised crime is defined along the lines set out in the US Organised Crime Control Act of 1970, as any structured criminal group that comes together to further its unlawful activities. While some organised crime groups covered have an element of political motivation, the book focuses primarily on those networks, syndicates and gangs whose main reason for existing is purely profit. While their constantly changing and adapting nature may make organised crime groups difficult to define legally, the shared features of both ancient and modern groups are easy to spot. Throughout history, many bands of pirates, bandits, slave traders and drug traffickers have enjoyed direct state sponsorship. When those groups lost official sanction and protection, they began ensuring the support they needed to carry out their activities through bribery. This practice established a matrix of political influence and crime that has become one of the defining qualities of organised crime throughout history. Other key characteristics of organised crime groups that have emerged over the last 4,000 years are that they challenge the state monopoly on violence, use fear as a method of controlling both their members and victims, and have a hierarchical system, an internal code. Their tendency to derive from resistance movements or from immigrant communities ghettoised by poverty and discrimination is another common element. Although there are tens of thousands of organised crime rackets, they are usually a variation of the basic themes of theft, supplying the illicit, exploiting the human condition, utilising fear to extract money and corruption. Chicago gang boss Al Capone often claimed he was like any other businessman, saying, "All I do is supply demand," and pointing out that capitalism is the legitimate racket of the ruling class. The implication was clear. He, like many other organised crime bosses, wanted his activities to be thought of in purely commercial terms. Yet any company, aside perhaps from arms manufacturers, whose business involved fear, violence, and adding to the total of human misery, would be shut down. Today, however, many organised crime groups have invested so much of their revenue in legitimate businesses that half of their profits now come from non-criminal operations. The distinction between illegal and legal commercial organisations is becoming harder and harder for the authorities to determine. Possibly the biggest lesson derived from studying organised crime is that it cannot simply be defeated by more police, harsher laws, or greater scrutiny and monitoring. If organised crime has been able to exist in the Soviet Union, the historical pinnacle of the police state, the idea that introducing new laws and more crime-fighting resource could ever totally eradicate the problem is clearly hollow. The history of organised crime also shows us that there are three underlying and recurring sources of crime: poverty, prohibition, and pure human greed. Given this, how can governments who wish, in the words of Tony Blair, to be tough not just on crime but the causes of crime, best serve their people? Surely it is impossible to legislate against the avarice that lies inside the hearts of so many of us. The only way forward, therefore, seems to lie in dealing with the other two prime criminal motivators, poverty and prohibition. Hope can rest in re-examining the prohibitions and systems of taxation that inspired so much organised criminal activity. For example, when Canada tripled its tax on cigarettes, made major investments in extra police to tackle tobacco smugglers, and introduced draconian penalties for anyone caught evading the duty, the end result was that its smuggling problem simply increased in line with taxation. The only ones to benefit from the rise in taxes were the organised crime gangs involved in butt-legging, underworld slang for tobacco trafficking, who saw their profits boom. However, in 1994, when Canada halved the tax on cigarettes, the government effectively starved the smugglers of the demand for their illicit goods, and organised crime was deprived of a major source of income. The bravery to apply this principle to other areas causes more concern to major criminal networks than any government talk of harsher penalties for crime or increased police budgets. Deprivation, hunger, and hardship have always been the largest causes and sustainers of criminal activity. From the East End slum area of Dickensian in London, known as the Rookeries, to Matunga shantytown in modern Mumbai, the link between the underclass and the underworld is clear to see. As criminal networks have become truly transnational in reach, one of the only logical ways left to fight them is to tackle the privations of poverty at a global level. Over the next few weeks, we'll be taking a peek at the history and growth of some of the most well-known syndicates, and a few newcomers too, and a brief look at some of the main activities, from money laundering and loan sharking, through vehicle theft and resale, extortion and blackmail, it's corporate and otherwise, to people trafficking, smuggling, arms, drugs, diamonds, tobacco, and funding of terrorism. Stick around. You might learn something.
Thank you to Malcolm Grieve for the history of the Mafia, Part 1. Now I'd like to introduce Chris Ironside, who's going to read a short story for us. Hello.
Hello. This is a social science studies story about a sixth form college called St. Joe's. Esmeralda slung her black satchel bag over her shoulder. She was going to be late for lessons. How on earth did I get into such bad timing, she thought. She nearly tripped over the kitten Contours. His marmalade markings had lent itself to the name, especially just after geography homework. "You can't call a cat Contours," Giles said. "You can call a cat anything," said Essie. "You're far too conservative, Giles. It will cause despair. People have to be allowed to be inventive, especially where naming is concerned. The neighbours think it's clever. They won't disapprove, which is also quite important. Just as well when you're calling in for tea, commented Giles. Philosophy was Esmeralda's new A-level subject. It was fascinating and so much more than dreams and woolly ideals than she had first thought. It had some answers to the great conundrums of life itself. It was, in fact, about the essence of life. The reason why, the solution to enduring joy of living. Why, alternates, of course, and not forgetting thinking of others. Philosophy was a hugely popular subject at St. Joe's. Happiness is an option. Happiness, actually, she said to Giles, is the option. You have to pursue it, but it comes in surprising ways sometimes. Live for others. Give everything you have away and you'll end up with nothing, said Giles. But there's more. You could be a hope person, said Esmeralda. Someone who carries hope into monumental halls of Arctic jeweled splendour, or expensive cars where the bulletproof windows stay shut, or deeply deprived houses where there is hardly anything at home. There's not much food. There's no hint of a world where there is natural beauty. And mothers cannot cry any more, as opportunities seem destined not to be for them or for their children. How can we hope if everything is jarred by walls too thick to climb over, too deep to tunnel under, a cage surrounding us? All those people can have is bread and bad schools. It was the sociology field trip that day in January. Snowdrops had broken through the dull, hard ground. They covered the fields around, waving in the breeze like an incoming tide. The walk in the old prison grounds was transformed by them. The sixth form had their coats on, packed lunch had been throwaway. It was still cold, but nature's upturned day. We are the ones who take the materials and shape them into something else. How could an opal look as good, or emeralds and amethysts be such treasures? It is really up to us, she thought. A blackbird trilled. I know, I know. There were some early crocuses beside the red brick prison wall, purple and bright yellow, where the temperature was up. New warmth was coming in gradually as the frost subsided.
Thank you very much to Chris Ironside.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
Every week it's time for the resplendent Jeff Sparks in his comfortable cardigan to talk about modern music and what's on this week.
Thank you, John. Good evening. This is your What's On guide from Dialect Radio. Starting with Friday 23rd of January, and at the Thunderbolt in Bristol, Kid Carpet will be performing. Doors open at 5 p.m. and tickets are £5 in advance and £7 on the door. Also on 23rd of January, at the Bunch of Grapes in Bristol, In Extremis will be performing. The gig starts around 9 p.m. and entry is free. On to Song of the Week, and this week I feature Johnny Thunders and the Heartbreakers. This is from the album LAMF, The Lost 77 Mixes, and is a track titled Can't Keep My Eyes On You.
Can't keep my eyes on you.
was Can't Keep My Eyes On You by Johnny Thunders and the Heartbreakers. Now that song featured vocals by Jerry Nolan, who passed away on January the 14th, 1992. Moving on to Saturday, 24th of January, and that's Area 81 in Lawrence Hill, Bristol, Monkey Fighters will be performing with support from Alien Stash Tin and also Zombie Met Girl. Doors open at 9 p.m. and entry is £5 on the door. Also on 24th of January and at Mr. Wolf's in Bristol, the Zen Hussies will be performing with support from the Bombardiers. Doors open at 8 p.m. and entry is £3 on the door. On to Sunday, 25th of January, and at the Tobacco Factory in North Street, Bristol, Rosie Plain will be performing with support from Jibo frontman James Hollingsworth. Doors open at 8 p.m. and entry is free. Finally, on 25th of January and at the Carnation Tap in Bristol, Steve Treble and the Harrisons will be performing. Entry is free and the gig starts at 4 p.m. That is all from me. Thanks for listening and have a great week. Take care and goodbye.
Well, that's all for this week's show. Thank you very much to Jeff Sparks there for the What's On Guide. Dialect is a community internet radio station broadcast on the web at dialectsradio.co.uk and on BTFM 93.2 in the Bristol area, and also in Preston, I believe. Hello, Preston. The show is run by the Bristol Radio Co-op and anyone can contribute. So that means you out there listening, well, if you're in Bristol anyway. If you'd like to, either in reporting or engineering, or just to come along and you just fancy watching what we do to see what perhaps you could contribute, then do so. Please get in touch by calling Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733, or you can find them on the web at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. Reporters this week were Tony Gosling, and thank you to our studio guests, Iqbal Tamimi and Chris Ironside, for her short story. Thank you to Jeff Sparks and his quiff and his hair and his lovely cardigan for his Watson Guide, and he'll be back next week. Studio production this week was by Tony Gosling, and the producer was also Tony Gosling. Bit of a one-man show this week. That was Dialect, and this is John Peters Coleman wishing you a very good week. Until next week, when we have Foxy Boxing, Turkey Fighting and Elvis Presley all here live in the studio. So thank you very much, and take care of yourselves. Goodbye.